Hey, Mark, we're going to start recording. Let's stand and face Jake together.
We pledge assistance to the fans of festive films outside of America and bring them to the public from foreign lands. Our mission, under God, unabashedly, with merriment and laughter for all.
Do we need to do this before every recording?
The following podcast contains graphic descriptions of international celebrating and global merrymaking. It may not be suitable for angry or unhappy audience members. Listener discretion is advised. You've been warned.
Have you ever seen any of those foreign films? I don't like them.
Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and some watch Christmas movies.
For Natale! God is camping!
We are the wild and crazy guys!
Well, they're both festive, aren't they?
We are the Festive Foreign Film Fans. Well, hey, Mark, we're out of hibernation.
Spring is here. Spring is here. How do you think I know? I just saw a bluebird. That is how I know.
Wow, Mark, for just waking up from a long sleep, you are so happy.
Bob, on the way to the studio, the air smelled so great. There were buds on the trees, flowers peeking up from the dirt, grass getting just a little bit hint of green, and it's now staying out light past 6 o'clock.
I know. You know, there's so much to be excited about. I really haven't thought about it before, but I listen to all that and what you're saying, and I envision it, and then I say, you know what? Let's talk about Christmas.
Well, you know, I love our podcast and how we celebrate the festive traditions, languages, and music of different cultures. I mean, we've been downloaded in 97 countries. 97 countries.
I can't even name them all.
And no way. That's more countries than we covered so far. I think we are creating some anticipation for what we do next. But before we get to tonight's countries, I'd like to take a minute to focus on the big F word.
Wait. Mark, come on, we're family friendly. No.
No, not the cuss word. I said the big F, the one that matters so much that it's in our name, film.
Ah, phew.
Bob, we are 1 week away from the Oscars, and although we don't talk about it much, this is the Super Bowl of the film industry. We may focus on festive films all year, but we like to watch all the Oscar-nominated films as well to fully absorb what the art form brings to the world. I like to think of it as training for our film critiquing skills. You know, once again, there were some excellent movies nominated for Best Picture. The storytelling was phenomenal. Table tennis playing Marty supreme.
Woo!
Shakespeare revisited with Hamlet.
Ooh.
The best version of Frankenstein I've ever seen. The odd but entertaining Begonia. The gory, scary, and confusing story of Sinners. And the less than impressive but still international F1. And two foreign films are nominated.
Woo!
The Secret Agent and Sentimental Value. I personally loved Sentimental Value.
First thing I got to say, now this explains tonight's outfit. This gold bodysuit, you want to look like Oscar, don't
it's
you?
It's giving it me a wedgie.
Does make you look a bit naked.
Actually, Bob,
glad you have that sword in front.
Oscar something, but ever since you created the Festy and we gave it to Jackie, I'm sorry, there'll be no other award I ever want to ever win.
As long as you ran through those movies, and Mark, he watches every movie nominated, and I love that about him, and I try to keep up with him, and I'm about halfway there. I'm not as far as he is, but I have seen about 5 of the movies, and I know you're going to be surprised by my choice. Now, I wouldn't have picked Begonia because at first I really didn't like it, but then it started to grow on me, so that one was pretty good. But the one that I've enjoyed the most so far, Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. I kept thinking about it after I watched it. And it's nothing like
Boris Karloff in that movie at all. Although there's a blind man in it. That's about the only crossover, I think.
It's a phenomenal movie. In fact, definitely in my top three for the year. I was blown away when I first watched that. Soon I put it on, and about, I'd say no more than 15 minutes in it, we paused the movie. I'm like, this is a phenomenal movie. So that's a good choice.
And that director too, Bella Toro, I love his creativity, the whole castle. The other thing too, he didn't expect the change of the perspective out of the blue. Like, oh, that's awesome.
No, good choice. Bob, I have some questions for you.
Ooh, is this trivia?
It's sort of like, yeah, sort of.
Okay.
What year did we start this podcast?
2023.
How many foreign films were nominated for Best Picture between 2000 and 2022? So over a 22-year period.
22, wow.
What do you think?
I have no idea.
Nine. So nine, with Parasite actually winning it in 2019.
Okay, this is trivia. It's an interesting point, but I don't really understand.
My point is that since our festive foreign film podcast began, there have been seven foreign films nominated for Best Picture. Seven in 3 years versus nine in 22 years.
Are you kidding me?
Bob, we are changing the world. We are opening the door for foreign films to enter the U.S. We are creating a more inclusive industry. We are officially influencers. We are golden. We're going up, up, up. It's our moment. You know, together we're glowing. Gonna be going.
Mark, up, up, up with our voices. You shouldn't be standing on your chair like Mark, you're going to fall down. And you're making me do math, and that makes my head hurt. But, Mark, I think we need a world tour, don't you?
I do. But, man, I know I should calm down, but listen. I am on page 3 of our Lifetime Achievement Award acceptance speech. How do you like it so far?
Mark, it's awesome. While you work on that, I think we need to get this episode started.
Oh, we got to go back to work. Okay. Let me take some deep breaths. Go ahead.
Now, tonight's film is interesting, talking about evolving and making changes. It was made during the Obama administration when there was an attempt to normalize relations between Cuba and the U.S., or as they say in the film, Cuba. And at first, it may not be apparent how this is a Christmas film. And I get it. As you know, I'm sure you can imagine, we'll talk about it later, but it's difficult to find films about a holiday that has been banned in a communist country. I mean, even the one we watched for Russia, it took place in the late 19th century. But this film documents the staging of the play Rent. And this is another one. Is Rent a Christmas story or not? Some really consider it because at the beginning and the end of the film, it's bookended by two Christmas Eves, and the holiday season is featured through the film. And one of the characters pretty much wears a Christmas outfit through the whole film. Right. So we'll review it. And it has a few different storylines. This is a documentary, so it has to do with the director who's returning to his exiled parents' homeland. So his parents were from Cuba and fled after Fidel Castro's revolution in 1959. And his father never saw the country again. And even the mother talks about how he always wanted to go back. And so she's very hesitant about her son's project in Cuba. So we got Putting on Rent, but we also have this side story, explores his heritage, the complex relationship to the country that they love. You can tell they love Cuba, but they didn't want him to go back and do this.
No, I thought it was really interesting. And you saw the mom get mad at the sister because the sister was trying to be encouraging. And I also thought the brother-in-law of Andy, too, he was just like, "Wait, fool, what are you doing?"
Yeah, he's bullish. Yeah, he's a bulldog. Like, don't you dare. Yeah. You're supporting Fidel Castro.
That part of the documentary was interesting.
So we'll get to the movie, and it's good. But, Mark,
yes,
before we do, I know we're reaching back. We're going all the way back pre our live show.
That's right.
To trivia from England. So, speaking of love, we need to return back 2 months to the country of England. And we'd asked in the trivia about the history and usage of the phrase, close your eyes and think of England.
We hope to now satisfy your old curiosity shop and end your hard times in a bleak house, because if you knew the answer, it is a small triumph worth celebrating. You have earned a sticker meant to fulfill your great expectations and to be proudly embraced like an old mutual friend. We hope you don't think of this as an Oliver Twist, because this phrase about England was used as advice during the Victorian era. It was given to brides-to-be by their mothers that they would have to go through that unwanted but inevitable sexual intercourse with their husbands.
I am blushing.
And their mothers would say it was their patriotic duty. They were just meant to grin and bear it, and they were to close their eyes and think of England. How do you think about that, Mark? Did you ever get advice like this for your wedding night?
Nope.
No?
Nothing.
No?
Got nothing.
Really?
Zero.
Come on.
Nothing.
I remember what my dad said to me. He said, remember, son, it's a sprint, not a marathon. So without the steak, you better sell the sizzle.
Good Lord.
Is that it?
That's it.
I listened to my dad. I took his words to heart. I'm proud to say that I finished in record time.
Oh, my God.
Well, that was fast.
Please. Please. Jesus, just take me now.
Oh, so anyway, I do know it's time to close our eyes and think of that sun-faded and weathered beauty of Cuba and discuss another documentary. And this one is called Revolution Rent 2019.
Want to watch a Christmas movie?
Christmas movies are our bread and butter.
We eat Chinese food and watch Christmas movies.
I heard it's the best Christmas movie since Home Alone.
Now, as you know, with documentaries, we have a hard time talking about the actors because they're real people. Right. What's ironic here is they're actors. They're not playing roles. They're being themselves. So the one who stands out the most is Andy Senor Jr. He's a writer, director, and actor. Andy was born and raised in Miami to Cuban exiled parents, as I said. He made his debut in the musical Rent as Angel. And a lot of people say he defined the role of Angel. He performed it on Broadway, in London, in both the national and international tours. He's had some film and television credits in Dummy, Lola, and Ed. And he later directed productions. So, you know, this one in Havana. Right. He also did one in Tokyo and Seoul. And the one in Havana became the subject of this documentary, which he also directed, because this was the very first Broadway musical production in Cuba in over 50 years.
Amazing.
Obama had made this outreach to try to normalize relations. And one of the first things we do is sent them over to put on this show. He has some other Broadway directing credits, included On Your Feet with Gloria Estefan and Holiday Inn.
There
another
you go.
Christmas connection. If you were familiar with the Broadway cast of Rent, you may know some of these people. Anthony Rapp, interesting about Anthony is the controversy that followed him later after he was in Rent. Anthony Rapp, he's an American actor and a singer, and he's from Joliet, Illinois. It's close by where Mark and I are. He started his career at an early age, 6. He received his first professional job at the age of 9. He was the one who originated the role of Mark Cohen in Rent on Broadway, and then he also reprised the role in the film adaptation of the musical, which Andy did not. Andy was not in the musical adaptation. He can also be heard on the original cast recording. He's had a number of film and TV credits. He played Commander Paul Stamets on the television series Star Trek Discovery. He also released an album called Look Around in 2000. But odd thing for being an actor and being in Rent, he's probably most known as bringing forward the allegation of sexual misconduct against Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
In 2017, after seeing the what had happened with the Me Too movement, he made the decision and he came forward with an accusation of sexual misconduct against Kevin Spacey. His accusation actually cost him a lot in his own career, but it did embolden 30 others to come forward with their claims of sexual misconduct.
Always that first brave step people take. But that's amazing what he
did. It is. And especially when you see what it cost him, right? Yeah. And then the third is Daphne Rubin Vega. Again, she originated the role of Mimi Marquez in Rent. She's an actress, a singer. She wasn't in the film adaptation. She's also known for her roles in Wild Things, In the Heights, and Sex and the City. Before landing the role of Mimi, Rubin Vega claims that she was not a big fan of musical theater. She had to be talked into actually being in Rent. She was the lead singer of a Latin girl group called Pajama Party, and they had three songs that hit the Billboard Hot 100 in 1989 and 1990.
Wow.
She's a big deal. So, okay.
She's a big deal.
All right. So I'm going to describe, as best I can, some of the components of it. Like I said, it's a documentary, and basically the storyline is really them going to Cuba to put on this play. It starts with the opening night on Christmas Eve, the writer of Rent who died. They say during the film, he always wanted the play to open on Christmas Eve, and it never did. Was the only time that they actually opened on Christmas Eve. They're nervous. This was probably a nod to Cuba. Have a drink of rum to settle your nerves before you go out on stage. So we have Andy there as a director, who also was the actor, got so much attention when Rent blew up and became such a big production. And I thought it was interesting that one of the quotes that they post early on from that writer of Rent was, "The opposite of war isn't peace, it's creation." It was perfect. So they go to Cuba. First production in 50 years. There's this whole discussion, as we described, with Andy and his family, his mom, his sister, his brother-in-law. His mom is not happy. And what's so interesting is she clearly is his biggest fan.
Right.
She talks about having seen Rent 60 times, traveling all over.
It is kind of cool how the document starts with opening night, a woman playing Mimi is about to puke multiple times. But then they go flashback, then the beginning of the story. Even though Cuba was in this new, a little bit more openness, people who came out gay were put in prison.
Yeah, they talked about them, that they had been put in their version of concentration camps.
Yeah.
It was interesting that that was the play that they selected to send, the first one to send over there.
I think they would have done Oklahoma or something.
Something more traditional. Yes.
Yeah, a little less controversy.
Right? Yes, yeah. And what I didn't expect, you go into it thinking, you're going to learn about how they put on a show and more about the political relations in Cuba. I didn't expect the whole family second storyline that really became much more meaningful, because you felt when they said the dad always wanted to go back and the mom goes back with Andy and sees where the church where they got married and he died and never got to go back. And it was just very touching.
It was very touching. And why their whole family was reluctant for Andy to go. Everybody does come over to Cuba to, she said, visit the old neighborhood and to see the actual production.
That conversation, when it ends, you would think, oh my gosh, they are going to resist. They're not going to go support him. And I understood both sides of the argument. Andy's saying, what better way to bring freedom to Cuba is to bring this play, put it on, have the people come see it, and they can appreciate the freedoms of the U.S. And the family's like, no, the government wants that. They want to be able to hold that up and say, look, we're doing this for you, but they're still going to keep the people oppressed. So I got both of them. But the mom does say she's happy at the end that he brought her back and she gets to experience Cuba.
The document then takes us through Andy's assembling of the cast and coming in for tryouts. And after the first day of tryouts, he's like, oh my God, I'm so underwhelmed. I mean, you think about the U.S. to Cuba. I mean, you know, Cuba has artists and singers and beautiful Cuban music and stuff, but certainly not Broadway or off-Broadway.
No.
Or off-Broadway.
It's not only maybe the actors aren't up to par or the same level they're used to. It is, we have blackouts. We have no electricity.
Yeah.
Oh, we're building the set. I told them what to do. I come back 2 days later, nothing's been done.
It's so rudimentary, but all that, they're still forging ahead. He's got a vision. He's got something in mind that he wants to do. And so he keeps persevering and he picks the actors that he wants to play the roles.
That's the drama of this that I guess I didn't anticipate. And I don't know how different it is from putting on a Broadway show here, but watching that crew evolve and really come together and put on that show, that I thought was fascinating to me. What is different. And I kind of felt for the actors. They did a lot where they would go and show where they lived.
Oh my goodness.
And I felt sorry for them because in some ways they were embarrassed and you saw the conditions that they live in. And to be fair, I'm sure that some of the actors that are trying to make it in New York, they don't live in probably the best places and that, but it was tough to see that.
Yeah. What year was the documentary, Bob?
2011.
2011. So it's not that long
ago. No, not that long ago.
But they had Pride.
I mean, you talk about the blackouts and no water.
Am I going to have water this morning?
No water.
Yeah. It's hard not to cast or go down a political talk track, but I think it's interesting how you talked about that cast at one point where they all just kind of admit each one of them was there just for themselves. Each one of them wanted to do their role and just be the best for themselves. And it's kind of getting close to the production time. And you know, Andy sort of has that come to Jesus meeting with them.
It's almost like he breaks them down.
Yeah.
It can't be this way. And I get like the one woman saying, I'm losing 400 Cuban dollars a day to do this. It's a struggle. So I felt for all of them.
I did too. Gosh, what a gift Andy gave them.
I agree. And you know what I liked is that you have all the actors who did it on Broadway, and you also have the choreographer, the music, the wardrobe person.
Wardrobe.
So what I loved that they had the perspective, because most of them had risen up from when it was off Broadway, when Rent just started. And they're like, this reminds us of the early productions, back when it was new and fresh. Yeah. And so they were kind of enjoying that again as well.
Right. The 80s were tough. Having a really close coworker of mine die of AIDS, I was not at all sensitive to what was happening until Mike died. But to, again, go back to Cuba, then to take that and go to Cuba and go to other parts of the world to get the message out. I mean, the message still resonates, whatever country you're in.
Yeah, and it resonated in 2011.
Yeah.
And I think I've told you the story, and it's fascinating because it's the 80s, right? It's the late 80s. Mary Ellen, when we were dating, where she lived in Chicago, she lived right next door. They opened a place called the Bonaventure House. And the Bonaventure House was run by these Jesuits monks. They traced their role back to the plague. They first started when they cared for people who were tossed out of the city. Then they took care of lepers. So their house, they took in people who had AIDS, whose parents had rejected. They were on their own. We met the guys and talked to them. But when they first opened, oh my gosh, there were big protests. And what was really terrible was there were a lot of church people who were protesting against it.
Very defining moment in our history.
And now we get to the big question. Opens on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
We see trees.
Yep.
We see some decorations in the background. Is this a Christmas movie?
I have a question. So when you first saw Rent, was it Rent the movie or Rent the play?
I never saw Rent the play. I meant to ask you if you ever seen it. I never saw Rent the play. I saw the movie, and I watched the movie because I had read that it was a Christmas movie.
The reason I asked that is, the first time I saw it was the movie as well, and then I saw it when Rent, when it came to Chicago. And do you know that in the play, there's a song called Christmas Bells that's not in the movie?
No.
So tonight, your homework, listen to it. The play felt more like a Christmas play than the movie felt like a Christmas movie.
Yeah, because there's just very slight elements in the movie.
But the Christmas bells, what's really a shame is when I heard it the first time, I'm like, oh my God. It's sort of a satirical song, like they're playing off actual Christmas songs. But I would say Rent is a Christmas movie, but it's really more a Christmas play.
Yeah.
How's that for a wishy-washy answer? And I would say this documentary opening up on 1224 kind of pushes me to say it is. What do you think?
Rent, I watched it. That was supposed to be a Christmas movie. I didn't really think it was much of one. So I'm watching this and I go, is this a Christmas movie? So through the whole time, because in some ways in my head, I'm also like, I'm going to have to justify to Mark why we're watching this movie. Is this a Christmas movie? And I struggle with it the whole time. What I found so interesting about it is I could say, yes, it is, because, like you said, opened on Christmas Eve and the decorations in the background. Although they're not talking about Christmas, they're not celebrating it. And then at the end, where some of the actors, what they desired out of this, they actually ended up going to the U.S. and living in the U.S. Fulfilled some wishes. It happens. I'm saying, yeah, it is Christmas.
Yeah, Christmas miracle, yeah. How'd you feel watching it?
I was surprised that I enjoyed it much more than I thought, because it was a documentary, and I have grown to love documentaries. I watch a lot of them now that I never used to. But a lot of times I can be detached from them. This one, the whole dynamic of, are you going to put on this play? Should you put on this play? What are we going to get out of this play? All those questions and watching them unfold, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I 100% agree. It was really well done. It's funny. I went back just to see, was it ever nominated for any BAFTAs or Golden Globes or anything like that? But it wasn't. But it's worthy. It's a worthy documentary. One, if you love Rent,
yeah.
which you know, that helped. Two, if you try to just put yourself in what they are accomplishing in the time frame they're accomplishing it, I think it's a pretty amazing story.
Would you watch it again?
Probably not. I don't think I would. There's anything to get out of it more. It certainly did make me want to go and watch Rent again.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I thought the same thing. I want to go back and watch that again. Because when they're doing parts of the scenes, I kind of remembered.
Yep. But I probably would not watch it again.
I would not either. But our other question in terms of would you recommend it? What is surprising to me is there have been times that we have covered countries purposely because of the political things that are going on. Russia and Ukraine, Palestine, Greenland. This one, ironically, wasn't picked because of that. But the minute we picked this, Cuba becomes a big discussion point. And even now, there's this whole, are we going to invade Cuba? Are we going to do something with Cuba, with the U.S.? So there is a part of me that recommend people to watch this, learn more about Cuba, you know?
Yeah, I would recommend someone to watch it. Again, I was probably the basis on, hey, do you love the movie? And in fact, I have to tell Brian was sort of the person who brought Rent to me.
Oh.
They did part of the music in one of the Fall Follies, and then he watched the movie, and then he asked for the movie for Christmas. And so we watched it. Well, here you go. I just had a memory flashback. We watched Rent for the first time on Christmas Day.
It always comes back to Christmas.
And I remember us all sitting there just weeping for lots of different reasons. So anyway.
I love that song too. And they sing it when they're all lined up, the song about the whole year. Yeah.
10,000, 25.
Yeah. I love that song.
Yeah.
The other thing that I did find fascinating, just to see the background, can't you see how Cuba in its time was beautiful?
Oh, yeah.
Some of those buildings, and I mean, they're falling apart and they're peeling. This one had to be a really fun place back in the day.
All right.
Now, Mark, we have learned how to say Merry Christmas in Spanish several times.
Yes, so we have.
And we've attacked it from different angles. And this, I was thinking, Cuba, it's Feliz Navidad. What do I do with this one? Right. Well, instead, I'm going to teach you how to say Happy New Year in Spanish.
Oh.
And really, and this goes back to even some of the discussion we had when we were talked about Russia. What the communists tried to do when they were banning Christmas is they tried to get the people who enjoyed the traditions and the customs of Christmas, they tried to move them to, hey, you can just do the same thing, just do it for New Year's. So this is how we say it. We say Feliz, we know that one. Feliz Año Nuevo.
Feliz Año Nuevo.
Yeah, see? Yeah. Feliz on Happy New Year. And so for decades after that 1959 uprising, Christmas was not officially celebrated and was not a public holiday in Cuba. Because of this, it does not have a huge nationwide following, although many Cubans celebrate behind closed doors. They just had to hide it away. Since January 1st marked the anniversary of the Cuban Revolution, that's why New Year's Eve became a huge holiday. Right. Big celebration, lots of fireworks, there's parties, family meals, dancing. That's why we decided to do Happy New Year. And again, this is similar to some things we've heard in some of the other Latin American countries. In preparation for the midnight on New Year's, you need 12 grapes, one for each month of the year, champagne or cider to wash them down, a bucket of water representing anything bad from the past year, and a suitcase if you're hoping to travel in the next year. And so their traditions focus on cleansing the old year and welcoming prosperity. So you eat 12 grapes at midnight. You try to eat all 12 in the first minute of the new year. You throw a bucket of water out the door to banish negativity. And if you plan to travel, you take your suitcase and you walk around the block with it. Again, meant to ensure good travel. Wow. What is so funny?
I like it.
You can find tons of YouTube videos of people doing all of these things. Yeah. Sometimes I'm like, is that true? Do they really do that? Yeah. I'd love to see these pictures of these people grabbing their suitcase and walking around the block. Okay, so are there Christmas customs? As much as they tried to ban it, hide it, put it to death, did not happen. There are some Christmas traditions, and we're going to talk about them. There are some places where they do celebrate Christmas quite spectacularly in Cuba. There's a town called Remedios that from 1820, they have had this festivity of Las Parrandas. It's grown so big, and now it's 18 communities in the center of Cuba have a famous Christmas festival. It's been going on for so long, and it's so well known. It's a huge carnival-like festival, and Remedios is one of the country's oldest cities. And the story goes that there was a young priest who noticed that around December 16th to Christmas, people were getting so busy that attendance at Mass dropped off. And he's like, well, this is a big time. It's Christmas time. More people should be coming to church. So what he decided to do is to attract the parishioners. He told local kids, go out into the streets and use whatever you kind of noisemaker you have, but make some raucous noise to attract people to the church. So horns, bugles, rattles, cans, whatever they could. And so then this tradition evolved, and then it became organized bands playing music in the street. And then they would compete against each other. Who could be the best band? And then the idea spread beyond Remedios. Then these other communities started getting involved. And then there became competitions between those different neighborhoods, and you'd have spies that were trying to spy on the other community, what they were going to do. So they'd prepare all year long for this competition. It would happen on the night of the festivity of Las Parrandas. So you have conga groups playing in the street, rumba dance parades, big colorful floats, fireworks shows, and decorations, lamps, lanterns, banners. Each neighborhood creates its own emblem, and they like to put stories on using lights and colorful shapes, and it's basically a massive street party.
Wow.
Doesn't that sound great?
Sounds like a lot of fun.
I know. And you know what? Just watching the people putting the show on, the actors, the music, they love dancing, and they love singing, and so I'm thinking, I'd love to go to Remedios. That would be really fun.
I think it'd be a lot of fun, too.
So, Noche Buena, Christmas Eve, which translates to good night. That's the important night for Cubans. It's actually Christmas Eve and not necessarily Christmas Day. That stems from the Spanish tradition and Spanish influence. It's celebrating Jesus' birth that night, as opposed to not that he's been born, but the fact that he's going to be born. That's what they celebrate. So some of the traditions, they feast, they go to the rooster mass, which we've heard of before, the Misa de Gallo.
Yes.
And again, sometimes this is referenced because of not having as much disposable income, but a little less focused on gifts, more focused on bringing the family together.
Right.
Serving meal, music, dancing. It's always described as extremely festive at its core, plenty of food, music. And I've even seen that a lot of times on the videos you see where they're all dancing. They put on the music and they dance. Because of the food shortages there, which we got a hint of in the documentary, sometimes the families have to save for weeks and months to collect the things that they need to make it really special. What are some of the things they make? This is the part we love, the food. One of the things, pig, whole roasted pig. The pig, I think that was from Brazil we saw too, where they like to roast the whole pig. The Mojo roast pork. The centerpiece of the feast is the roasted pig known as lechon. It's cooked on a spit in a pit and turned around, and the Cubans will put a stick through the pig, place it over a fire, and cook it very slowly. The authentic Christmas lechon is made by digging a pit in the backyard and slowly roasting the whole suckling pig. However, as an easier alternative, you just use a fatty cut for roasting, like the butt is recommended, but they often will use the shoulder. And they say the process lasts the entire day. You always have several family members who are involved in the cooking and the prep time just to get the meat prepped. The pig ready 72 hours before. And what do? You use your mojo sauce. The mojo sauce is made a few days before because the longer it sits, the more flavor it gains. It's herbs and spices and seasoning, and it's made with naranja agria or sour orange. So get the sour orange, lots of garlic, olive oil, chopped onion, white vinegar, oregano, cumin, salt, and pepper. They say it's heavily garlic citrus that you marinate your pig in for 24 hours to penetrate the meat. And sometimes you even inject it into the pork to make it more tender and flavorful. Most Cubans will describe the aroma of the pig wafting through the air as one of their happiest Christmas memories. And guess what?
What?
That pig meat, that is what they use for your Cuban sandwiches. Yes. Oh, so
yummy.
I'm just curious. Sour orange, garlic. Does that appeal to you? That like description of that flavor?
Yes. There's a short answer. I found anything with cumin in, sometimes that can be a dominating taste. And so it has to be the right mix.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah,
it sounds it does to me too. I'd love to try that. What will they serve with it? They serve congri rice or, I love this, moros es cristianos or moors and Christians. Black beans and rice. And it's made with bacon fat. People say it's the perfect side dish because it absorbs that mojo citrusy garlic flavor. Yuca is another traditional Nochebuena side dish to serve with Cuban roast pork. They say yuca and roast pork are a food power couple. And yuca is a root vegetable commonly known as cassava. You can broil it, you can fry it, you can mash it, and it's covered in mojo criollo. Criollo is what you use as a dip. So this is what you dip things in. Saute the ingredients with lime to create a sauce that is citrusy and provides a flavor boost. You also might have tostones or plantanos. Oh, I know we've heard these before in Latin America. Those are crisply double fried plantains.
Yeah.
Yes. But these ones are a little bit crispier. So you got your rice and beans. You got your pig. You got your yuca. And now you got your fried plantains made from ripe green plantains, sliced and fried until tender in the middle, but crisp on the edges. You also might serve some Cuban bread. Cuban bread, the reason why it's different, what makes it a more unique flavor, they make it with pork lard. Again, pork. And then finally, what you're going to have to serve to drink, crema de vie, it's Cuban eggnog. The name translates to cream of life. And it's a bit of an odd name because crema is Spanish and V is French, so it's Spanish and French, but the Cubans will pronounce it crema de vía. Cubans have a sweet tooth, so it's really sweet. Simple syrup, sweetened condensed milk, cinnamon, egg yolks, vanilla, and white rum. This one is more of a sweeter eggnog.
That sounds good, though. Yeah. I would try it.
Yep. And then finally, for dessert, yuca buenelas. Again, yuca comes back. Buñuelos have a long history in Cuba. Their roots can be traced back to Spanish influences. And again, these are usually served for Christmas. You combine yuca, Cuban pumpkin, which is calabaza, and bonito, which is Cuban sweet potatoes. They're boiled and mashed to create a dough. So you make this dough, then the dough is shaped like the number 8. Which is supposed to represent, we know, infinity, the infinity sign. And then they fry it and cover it in syrup. And so it's mild with a sweet, nutty taste. I've seen online people say when they think most of Christmas,
right,
it's the buñuelos. Buñuelos, and I think the pig.
Yeah, the buñuelos sound really good.
Yes, yes.
I've never heard of those before.
You've never heard of yuca. And they use it in so many different things. They use it like mashed potatoes, then the dessert.
I've seen yuca and sale at grocery stores.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So for our next international meal.
I'm not trying to influence the selection in June for favorite food, but this is up there.
I wish we could have a Festive Foreign Film Fans giant potluck and everyone bring all their different food. Well, Mark, how about some music? Ready to dance?
Let's do it.
Cuban.
This calls for some Christmas music.
Yes, this Christmas music.
What kind of Christmas music is that?
The least you could do is play some Christmas music.
And now back to Christmas music. mi canción no es tan solo de quien pueda escucharla, porque a veces el sordo lleva más para amarla.
So Mark, that is Canción de Navidad by Silvio Rodríguez. It's the Christmas song. It's by a Cuban singer, songwriter, and poet, Silvio Rodríguez. It's from 1994, and it's just his voice and his guitar. This acoustic ballad, what's funny about it, it's a poetic critique of consumerism. In some ways, you can say, was it an anti-Christmas song? It's really more of a reflection on the ironies that surface during the holiday season. It begins by painting a picture of the commercial and celebratory aspects of the end of the year, with people shopping and sending well wishes. And then what Sylvia does, he juxtaposes that with the reality of people who are less fortunate, who just need the basic necessities of life, such as shelter. It's to remind you of the message of Christmas. But what is great about this song, I think, is, especially when you think of somebody who lives in a communist country, you would think that he would embrace the common trope that say wealthy people are terrible and evil, and that poverty is a virtue and the people who are poor are virtuous. And he says, look, those who are born into favorable circumstances do not have to sacrifice it themselves. Being born with all your basic needs met puts you just in a different position in life from others. It's not about that being good or bad. It's simply about that society doesn't give everyone the same opportunities. Right. So we just have to be aware of this contradiction. He's not saying if you're born wealthy, that doesn't mean you're necessarily bad. You just have a lot of advantages that other people just don't get when they're born. And he wants to dedicate a song to those who don't give much and have to struggle every day and they get overlooked. And he's like, you know what? Nobody ever sings to these people. Well, I'm going to sing. It's about those who ask for life at the mangers. They have nothing. They start their life as Jesus did. So it's a tribute to those he feels are unseen and just tells the listener, hey, remember, let's just embrace humanity. What it's a great message to me is it doesn't just say, you're bad if you have money. It just remember that we all don't have it. And sometimes that's just unfair.
It's relevant for communist countries as well as free countries.
Yeah. You know, right away, I think we'd think, oh, he's communist. He's going to attack the wealthy. No, he's just saying, I want to dedicate a song for the people who don't have the nicer things in life.
It's Christmas dinner.
Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Food they put out for Christmas Eve.
Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Most of your major food preparation holidays, Christmas.
Eat it.
What's up, food for Santa?
Eat it. If it's getting cold, reheat it.
There's no chili. No, chili's not a festive food.
Have a banana.
After having our first taste of our little Latvian bacon pillows, we seem to have gotten away from our pierogi culinary adventure. Oh. We need to remind ourselves that our aim here is not just to eat the pierogies, but we want to make the pierogies. And we don't want to just produce some fake American knockoff of them. We want the real thing. We want to replicate the true Latvian experience, which brings us to today's predicament. Speck. Now, if you remember when we were talking about pierogies and we talked about speck, it is the traditional double smoked bacon. And it just begs the question for Mark and I, who are not grill masters, we're not Daryl, cooking with Daryl.
Not in close.
What the heck is double smoked bacon? What is it? So our first response, we did what every smart chef does. We know in today's environment, I think I saw them do this on The Bear. They turned and they said, hey, ChatGPT, tell us about speck and how to make it. Well, I did. I asked ChatGPT and the answer was not helpful or it was not insightful. It did nothing. What it said is, hey, speck is a traditional cured and lightly smoked ham from South Tyrol in northern Italy. Okay. It's somewhere between Italian prosciutto, which is air-dried and unsmoked, and German-Austrian smoked hams, which are air-dried and gently smoked. Okay. Wow. We've
That's
gone
exciting.
From unsmoked
That's riveting.
To general, but none of that sounds to me like double smoke. They said light smoke, kind of smoked. Then Chat says, hey, and guess what? It's eaten thinly sliced with rye bread, butter, and pickles, and wrapped Ooh. Around breadsticks or bread.
That sounds good.
Or put into Alpine dishes like dumplings, pasta, or eggs. So no mention of Latvia, no mention of pierogies. What do we do? We need to ask someone, how do we smoke meat? And how do we double smoke it? Does that mean we just do it twice in one day or what?
Use twice as much wood? I don't know.
So, Mark, you know what we did?
I think I do.
We turned to the pit whisperer. And who is that? We know that Mark's one son is a brewmaster. Well, guess what? The other one, he knows how to smoke meat. And I'm sure he's not ever double smoked anything. But at least, since we're all winging it here, like us making pierogies, he can wing double smoked bacon. We're going to ask Mark's son, Eric, about smoking meat. And you may think we're really interested is finding out about double smoked speck bacon. No, our main goal here is just get some free smoked meat samples in exchange for him getting free airtime.
I don't know if he wants any airtime, but maybe. Maybe he'll do it for his dad. I don't know. Well, I'm very lucky because I have a son who likes to cook delicious meat and wheat recipes and a son who makes phenomenal beer. So thank God their mother raised them because they've turned out to be two great men and two great hobbies.
And you've just described this beautiful spring weather.
Yeah.
The light. I see a backyard. I see a grill. I see some premium thick cut pork belly. I see some fresh brewed Brian Chandler beer, some dry cured with spices, bacon. Mark, can you describe a better afternoon?
No. Well, I guess if somebody's willing to close their eyes and think of England.
Well, Festa fans, we're really excited tonight to have with us a master chef, Eric Chandler. He is my...
Are you bursting with pride?
Yeah, always for my kids. They always make me happy and proudful. We've been on this mission, this path to make the perfect pierogi. We've talked to dignitaries like Sabine. You've talked to the Englishman who lives in Latvia who has the perfect pierogi recipe. We've had pierogi shipped in from Etsy from New Hampshire. And so we're getting closer and closer. But one of the things Bob has pointed out multiple times is that to make the perfect pierogi, we need to have smoked baking. In fact, right, Bob, it has to be double smoked baking.
Double smoked, yep.
I mean, that's like double barreled aged beer. We know so little about cooking anyway. When it comes to smoky meat, we know even less if it's possible. So we invited the only person we know who knows how to smoke meat. And that is Eric. And so, Eric, welcome to the Festa Foreign Film Fans.
Thank you very much.
Why do people smoke meat?
It's a flavorful thing. The big thing behind smoking is like the low and slow. And if you're doing low and slow, that you're going to retain those flavors, where a lot of times if you put something on at a really high temperature, you might lose some of that fat rendering. You're going to lose some of that flavor. And I think a mark of someone who likes smoked meat is when you're done, there's a smoke ring, which means like when you cut into your meat, if you look quarter inch in, you'll see this red ring that indicates where the smoke was cooking. So for me, though, I think it's all about flavor. I think that barbecue smoky flavor is what people are after with the smoking.
How did you become interested in smoking meat using a smoker?
My father-in-law, for my 30th birthday, bought me a Traeger smoker. It was kind of when Traegers were very much so becoming in vogue. And a couple of my buddies also had Traeger smokers at the same time. And it's just become kind of a hobby I like to do on the weekends and can make a couple meals for my family here and there.
I also read about that people your age, guys who are in their late 20s to early 30s, this seems to be this crazy phenomenon where you guys are sharing recipes. How do you think that came about?
We're in a time and a generation where cooking is equal opportunity for everybody. And I just feel like being outside, being in the backyard, the barbecue over the summer, those are things that I think me and my buddies in our generation have gotten into, which I think is a pretty good safe habit to have.
I'm curious if there's a type of wood that you always use when you smoke, or is it just you vary it based on the kind of flavor that you want?
I think some of the ones that you would see as staples would be oak, mesquite, and hickory. And then just like recently, I think people have messed with apple wood or cherry wood as a little bit more fruit-based. The one blend that I get, and I think it has mesquite, hickory, and oak as sort of the staples that you would like to use.
So how do you choose what type of wood to use?
If you want something that's sweet and fruity, and maybe like the rub that you're using also is sweet and fruity, and you're making pork, then that's a good fit for you. So I think a lot of it is also sort of, hey, are you making porks that are going to be for pineapple tacos? Or are you making pork that's going to be for pulled pork barbecue sandwiches? So there's some indication of, hey, what am I using this meat for? That could also help indicate the type of wood that you would want to use for the flavor that you're going for.
What's the prep time before you actually smoke a piece of meat?
It really depends a lot on the meat and then the rubbing you're selecting and like, are you using a binder? I would say the meat that I've done that takes the most amount of prep time and is like the most finicky is almost certainly a beef brisket, where there's a lot of meat trimming that goes into that preparation. There's the rub that you would use. There's two different parts of that meat. There's the flat and the point. Some people separate those. So if you're doing a brisket, I know I was the first time I did it. One of my buddies came over to help me. We were like looking at YouTube videos and it took a lot of time and prep. And then afterwards, you know, some people use injections to like help make the meat a little more juicy. And then there's every rub out there in the world that you can use. And a rub is essentially just a mix of different spices and herbs. And there's super pepper-based ones. There's like paprika-based ones. And you could pretty much get a rub for like any type of meat. So I think when you're trimming the meat, when you're considering your rub, the other thing that is important to consider is like your binder. And so the binder is what is helping the rub stick to the meat. For example, if you're making ribs, I use a binder of yellow mustard as well as like a Worcestershire sauce, and that helps the rub stick more to the meat. I think total prep time, if you're making a brisket, it could take you an hour plus to prep. If you are throwing together pork shoulder that's pretty simple, it could take 10, 15 minutes top to prep. So kind of depends on cut of meat and what you're looking to do.
Good thing you like pork, because that is what we're focusing on here tonight. It's bacon. Have you heard the concept of double smoked? And what is that? What do you think that means? Is it just you get it really, really smoky or what?
You know, that's a great question. I honestly haven't. If it were double smoked, I think that would just indicate that at some point it was taken off the smoker and then maybe was able to cool and then smoked again. I have no idea what the purpose or point of that would be. But I think it's like double IPAs or double barrel aged stout. At the very least, it sounds cool to say.
I struggle too. Is it to make it really, really smoky? And then wouldn't that just be you just keep it on longer instead of doubling it? But there must be some purpose to it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, we're going to have to investigate it more and figure out. It's a mystery. So Bob, so far, like I'm a little worried because we have to scold our flour, we have to bind our meat, we have to inject things hopefully into the meat, not one another. This is starting to get a little complicated.
It sounds like a science experiment. That's the part that scares me.
That also gets you guys in jail at this point with some of those verbs you're using.
We've been close to jail a few times. So you mentioned social media. For our live show, we had this guy Cooking with Daryl. Have you ever listened or watched any of his Instagram posts or YouTube videos?
Yeah, a ton. When you guys had Daryl on your live show, not that you two aren't the attraction, but when I texted it out to my buddies, they're like, oh my gosh, like Cooking with Daryl is going to be on there. All of my buddies knew that name and had seen his videos. And for me, he does a lot of awesome videos that are like simple, straightforward, and anybody who watches his videos can make them. I love making smash burgers. That's one of my favorite things to make for big groups of people. And I use his recipe and his seasonings to a tea whenever I use those. So there's just some staples that he's made that have been very approachable for people to make. And he's entertaining. He's also sponsored by some companies that I like. A bunch of my buddies wear the Rohrbach golf gear, and he's sponsored by them too. So he
don't rub that in, Eric. Yeah, he's got sponsors.
He's more popular than he is sponsored, Bob. Two of the nerves that are always exposed for us, and Eric hits them both.
Does Cooking with Daryl, does he smoke meat too?
You know, I haven't seen him do a lot of smoking. I know that he does a lot of work with steaks and veal. I think he does just like a lot of meat-based things and stovetop. I'm sure he has it within his repertoire, but it hasn't been what I've used him for a lot over the last couple of years.
So, Eric, big question. Have you ever heard of smoking bacon? Have you seen any videos on it?
I was thinking about this when I heard about your adventure with bacon, and it's pork. And honestly, the best thing that I've ever smoked is pork base. Pork is, to me, one of the kings of barbecue. So I don't think you can go wrong. I've never heard of somebody smoking bacon because I think it's one of those things that's hard once it starts cooking. I think people want to eat it like now. The whole thing about smoking is the low and slow over time. And I just don't know many people who have the patience and the will to not eat bacon quickly and cook it quickly. I've made one recipe that had bacon in it that I smoked, but smoking it wasn't a critical part of the recipe.
Eric, and this is what's odd to me, is when we say bacon, we picture what we think of as bacon, but it seems like different countries call different things bacon, or there's varieties of it. They say, oh, it's the pork underbelly, and they're still referring to it as bacon.
Think about what ribs look like. I think they might smoke a big piece of meat that looks more like ribs than the actual bones. I wonder if that's what bacon they're smoking. What do you think?
Yeah, and that would make a lot more sense to me if there was one set of meat that I think gets way better when smoked versus any other way of cooking it. It's ribs. Pork ribs. Can make them every week. I love having them. I love trying them from other people. So if that's the case, that's going to be a delicacy by the end of your smoking opportunity.
At least it sounds like pork improves with smoking. And no matter what, whether it be a bacon, speck, whatever this is, it's going to be pork and it's going to get smoked. So you're saying that it's probably going to improve and cover the rest of our deficiencies, right?
No doubt.
So it sounds like, I mean, I'm not trying to say or put words in your mouth or remind you that I'm the papa for your daughter, but it sounds like you might be interested in maybe helping us experiment and smoke some bacon in your backyard.
I've known both of you for a long time, and it was not lost on me that this might just be a whole setup for you guys to come to my backyard and use my Traeger grill. And I'm not above allowing that. And quite honestly, the only thing that I would say is the only rule that you have, if you are smoking meat, whether you're starting at 6 a.m. in the morning or you're doing it at 3 a.m. with an overnight smoke, is you have to have a beer in your hand. So you are both allowed in the backyard if you have a beer in hand as we do it.
What if you have a beer in both hands and then you can't really help? Do I still get to be there?
That's a cheat code right there. That's perfect.
We thought that was the price you were going to have to pay because you didn't bring us any samples of smoked meat tonight, which I thought was part of the deal, part of the interview.
Well, I tell you what, I have enjoyed making meat, especially just for my family. I love having my mom, my dad, my brother, their family, and everybody over to smoke meat. Because another big piece of smoked meat is you bake it and it lasts for five meals afterwards. Bob, I think that you are now on the list of people who will get meat next time I make it.
Oh, yeah. Mark and I will serve pierogi.
What does one wear when they serve pierogi? Because I think all your listeners are probably envisioning that right now. What you two would wear as you serve.
Our traditional Latvian costumes, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, we've learned, right, that pierogies served there were weddings and formal dinners and at Christmas time. I mean, definitely a Christmas staple, but I think you can wear whatever you want. Eric, we're going to hold you kind of, we know that timing for this, we're going to have to work around some upcoming major events occurring at the end of April, but that's okay. We'll work around your schedule, Nancy's schedules, and figure out the right time, but we appreciate you coming on tonight, talking a little bit about your smoking abilities and giving us some insight. I mean, I'm glad we have to have a beer in our hands to do this.
That means we're halfway there, Mark.
Right. I mean, easy bake oven with beer in our hands. That's what I'm taking from this.
The first puree that this baby boy is going to have is going to be double smoked bacon puree.
That I could do. Push a button. Puree. Got it.
Well, Eric, you are the smoker extraordinaire. I wish there was a better name for it. I couldn't think of one, though. Smoker.
There's definitely some possible nicknames you don't want to have. I appreciate you guys having me on, and I know that all the different traditions that you guys bring to the table and, you know, inform people on are really cool. So I appreciate getting to be a part of that.
Well, and tell all those buddies that we may not be Daryl, but at least we got you on our show. Maybe they'll listen.
So that's a bad one. I think they'll for sure not listen if they want to hear me, or they'll just razz me. So
yeah, well, some of those buddies, if I happen to run into them, they thought Daryl was so cool, but did they show up at our live show, Bob? I don't think so. We'll remind them. I'm not above shaming people into liking me.
But we know that, Mark.
You want to hear some trivia?
No.
It's trivia. It's
trivia. Trivia.
You don't think there's any trivia that can top Close Your Eyes and
you
Think
know
of
what?
England?
If it has anything to do with Fidel Castro, I don't want to hear it.
Well, Mark, as we know, Cuba is incredibly close proximity to the United States.
Yes.
At its nearest point, Cuba is 90 miles south of Florida.
It's incredible how close it is.
Makes it a bit awkward because as this Caribbean island nation has been socialist since the 1959 Cuba Revolution,
yeah,
we are so close geographically and yet so politically distant, which has created some interesting minutiae between our two nations.
Well, minutiae.
That's our first question, though, that we thought about assessing you on. How about the fact that the U.S. has been sending checks annually for $4,085 to Cuba for the lease of Guantanamo Bay, and since 1959, only one of those checks has been cashed? It's the dumbest thing.
It's the incredibly dumbest thing ever.
Or how about in the 1960s, when U.S. biplanes were taking photos of Cuba, they noticed something peculiar. They were building soccer fields in Cuba. And guess what? We knew that the Cubans don't like soccer. They like baseball. But guess who likes soccer? The Russians. So that is how we first took notice, and that was the start of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I never heard that before. I got to go back to my history teacher.
And look at this. We considered quizzing you about another odd detail, that after the 1959 Cuban Revolution, and when Cubans are aligned with the Soviet Union, and it led to all these decades of Cold War tensions and a break in diplomatic relations, it was as if the Cubans stopped buying new cars. Because guess what? Most people in Cuba today, they drive old American cars from the 1950s.
Yeah.
In fact, there are about 60,000 classic American cars in Cuba today, and they would be collector's items anywhere else. And you see them in this movie.
It's amazing.
And I love it because it's the big old 1950s with the huge doors. They're beautiful cars. And on the positive side, although Cuba's socialist model has led to persistent economic inefficiency and material shortages of goods, the government did prioritize education. And Cuba has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. 99.8% of the people can read. Isn't that amazing? Think about that. 99.8%.
I don't even want to know what the U.S. is. Do you know? I don't even want to
know. I don't even know. Ours is probably like 60. I don't even know. Here's what we thought. We thought, this is something fun. If we asked everyone what was the biggest economic export from Cuba, everyone would say what?
Cigars.
Right. Of course you'd say cigars. Yeah. And you would be wrong. This is a result of another focus by the government, and it allowed Cuba to lease approximately 50,000 of these to different countries, and it generates $11 billion a year in revenue. They are exporting something. What is it? It's not cigars. 50,000 of them going out into the world, generating an estimated $11 billion a year. Now, if you know, we have a colorful collective space for you. It is not one surface. It becomes part of the larger community where it is applied. Yes, it is our humble 4S sticker is equally available to you, member of the peasant class, to quietly bide its time on your cooler or water bottle, harmless, while dreaming of revolution. No, it is not of the luxury class, but just a common adhesive with a sense of purpose, ready to be slapped somewhere new to continue the struggle. When enough of our stickers are distributed throughout the world, they will appear together and rise up. Our sticker's power is strongest when it's shared by everyone, rather than reserved for the few.
Wow.
So send in your answer now to festivefans@gmail.com, and you will secure a sticker that we can all share, comrade.
I'm excited.
I do have a quote for you, though, before we go.
What is it?
Christmas gives us the opportunity to pause and reflect on the important things around us. That's by David Cameron. It's not as stirring as our sticker speech, though.
Not at all. I mean, it's kind of a letdown after that. Was such a great speech.
I know.
That's going to show up someplace. It's going to be...
Rise up with me, sticker holders.
Exactly. It's like a revolution.
Well, holy cheese, Batman. Our next episode is about Switzerland. Grab a hunk of raclette to melt and join us in the shadow of the majestic Alps as we watch the 2024 film, The Very Last Christmas, that you can find on YouTube. And now, Mark, today's episode reminds us that decades of communism in Cuba sought to suppress and eliminate Christmas, but it still survived, hidden in homes and hearts. Christmas now flourishes in Cuba again, showing how tradition, generosity, and hope can never be extinguished. The festive fans find this a powerful example of persistence and triumph of the human spirit. Look at it. We're just so motivated right now.
You know, I feel like, you know, we talked about a musical today. I mean, I feel like, what's that song?
One Day More.
I mean, that's the kind of feeling I have right now. I'm just going to go out and start a revolution.
Let's just go march on Jake.
Let's go march on Jake. Uh-oh. Here we come, Jake. We better end this now.
We better. Good night, Mark.
Good night.
Actually, we're done.
It's over. It's over.
It's over. Kaput. Finito.
It's over. It's over. It's over.
This has been a Waysound Studio production.
And sound engineering on our show is by Jake Fontana.